This audio, recorded at the 2010 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair, is about the reform movement in Iran and the Million Signatures campaign in particular. You'll find more audio from the book fair at www.wsm.ie/bookfair.
Women's evidence is half of that of men. Women are restricted, extremely restricted when it comes to participation within the workplace, within society in general, within education. Therefore, obviously, the barriers for women in Iran in terms of their participation in civil society, their ability to be equals, it's not just simply about wearing a veil or not wearing a veil. That's really just a representation of the institutionalized inequality. The restrictions on dress in Iran reflect a much deeper problem. For women, I think, in Iran, one of the things that has always struck me, and I've been somebody who's been interested in the question of Iran for many years, and have known Iranian women who've come to Ireland or to Britain and spoken to them about their experiences and taken an interest in films about Iran, but it's the fact of the lack of any sort of personal space, any personal freedom to express yourself and how you look and how you behave and who you are. That's, I think, although that may sound in many ways to be something that's very superficial or something, well, not superficial, that's the wrong word, something that's minor compared to the problems with unemployment and all those other issues, it is actually an extremely important human right and extremely important human need. So because of the fact that the state acts as a check at all times on women's freedom, it actually really harasses women constantly. The people will know or have seen the morality police, the hate of morality police on the streets of Tehran and other cities who continually accost women because, like many young women in Iran, refuse to cover up completely in the way the state wants them. They harass them, they accost them on the street. They also question women, arrest women, and imprison women who are seen or thought to be with a man who is not their father or their brother. Women are not allowed to be seen or to be with other men in public. And we've seen things like, you know, for instance, and I'll mention this again later, there was, a very excellent film made by the filmmaker Jafar Panahi, who's recently just been released from custody in Iranian prison, in Evin prison, a film called Offside, which is an excellent film which shows will girls in Iran dressing up as boys just to go to the World Cup qualifier in Tehran in the 1990s. The film itself exposes the almost the ridiculous nature of the restrictions that are placed on women and girls. And something where, you know, in football, it seems as though this is something that's, you know, not something directly political, but it's something that these girls, like many women here in Ireland and elsewhere, take a keen interest in. But they're not allowed to go to the stadium because they're not allowed to be in a space where they're not segregated from men who are not their fathers or their brothers. Many other restrictions exist in terms of ability to take part in social activities. In terms of how this all came about, well, people will have heard of the coming into being of the theocratic state in Iran in 1979. People will also, many of you will have heard about the revolution that preceded that. And I would take issue with people that would consider that revolution to have been an Islamic revolution. For me, understanding it, that it was very much a mass movement for change. The problem in Iran, however, was that yes, there was a religious component, yes, there were religious people, but the left was very weak, and the left either didn't, because it was too weak, or also because it was politically weak, take on the politics and the leadership of the Ayatollah Khomeini, who came back to Iran at the time. So the coming to power of this, of the Ayatollahs in Iran, was really, it was a defeated mass revolution. And its consequences have been only too painfully borne by the people of Iran since then, in terms of the restrictive society they've had to live under. The fact that Khomeini spoke in terms of anti-imperialist this and anti-imperialist that led many to believe that he really was an anti-imperialist, and obviously we've seen a very different story. The regime itself is divided, again people will probably be aware, between the conservatives and the reformists, and we've seen sort of the ascendancy of the reformists over 2009-2010, with Mustafi being somebody who was voted for, but unfortunately for him, not least, he was unable to take his position as the new president of Iran because of, undoubtedly, clearly known about, vote rigging and corruption. But I would say myself that both the reformist wing and the conservative wing are really are part and parcel of the same beast. Throughout the years from 1979 through to today, we've seen different tempos in the reign of society, different levels of oppression, and we've had periods where the reformers have also been in power. But the one thing that they cannot do and do not do is bring about democracy. They cannot accept rule through repression. And Mousavi himself and his supporters, and some of his well-known supporters like Khatami, when they themselves were in power, they too played a similar role to the government that we've seen over the last 18 months. They too butchered people down in the street. They too repressed women. They too played that nakedly vicious role. And certainly, women in Iran have not been compliant, not been easily compliant. Under extremely difficult circumstances, they have continued to struggle against the oppressor, and very, very bravely so. From where I mentioned before, 1979, prior to that, women had taken a full role in the struggle to bring down the Shah, the hated Shah. Now, sometimes people, especially apologists for the American regime, would have this belief that the Shah was so much more progressive than the current regime, but he was hated precisely because of his repression, of his hand-in-glove relationship with the United States and his treatment of his people as simply fodder to feed to his factories to make him produce wealth. But after the revolution in 1979 and with the coming to power of Khomeini, it clearly became apparent to the women who had taken part in the revolutionary struggle that really this was not going to be the beginning of a new dawn for them. Very soon, restrictions came into place where the veil was reintroduced on a mandatory basis, and many would say that the left, and some of the left at the time, can be very seriously criticised for the fact that they didn't take these things seriously. They thought, well, look, you know, these are just things we have to live with for now. You know, in time we will sort of, but it actually was really the beginning of the end for women's rights in any in terms of any advances that had been made in the period 1979. There was a major crackdown on women's rights which has remained in place since then. But I've mentioned that women do continue to struggle, and I think if you know you look at world events, demonstrations throughout the world, particularly on International Women's Day, you will see women coming out in force every March the 8th in Iran, and coming out at considerable cost to themselves and at risk of a considerable danger. Many hundreds of women are routinely arrested and harassed, their families suffer problems, but nevertheless they continue to wage that struggle, and I think that they obviously need to be commended and supported in that struggle. And Farah is going to say something about the 1 million signature campaign, a campaign which is apparently simply for legislative change within an Islamic framework. But I think myself, and she'd say a bit more, that it's, although it seems quite, I mean, it doesn't go far enough, it nevertheless has a very radical base and has the support of many millions of women, even if they haven't been able to sign it, and men as well in Iran. Then we had 2009, and I thought that, you know, looking at the images on our screens from demonstrations in Iran and in Shiraz and all the other Iranian cities before the clampdown on the broadcasting was imposed, it was it just seemed such an exciting time for particularly young women. I mean, I saw images of women dancing in the streets, being able, as I've already described, the terrible restrictions on even the most ordinary, mundane life, day-to-day activities, being searched continually in case you've got makeup in your bag, being harassed continually for walking on the streets with some hair showing, being harassed if you go out in public with a man, to then being able to go on the streets and, I think, for the first time, be able to really participate and involve yourself and express yourself in a living movement alongside your brothers, your friends, you know, young men and young women from universities taking to the streets together and participating in these events together was just such a burst through of all of that pent-up energy, I think, that's existed for so long. And when you think of it, for this generation, they know nothing but the Islamic regime. This has been their experience, and they hardly want rid of it. And I think, although the movement has gone through its ups and downs in Iran since then, and certainly at the moment it is definitely going through a lull, I sense, and also we're not able to really see what's happening to any great extent because of the fact that there's been a complete ban on broadcasting, and where we only get what people can capture themselves from their mobile phones and put up on YouTube or whatever. I certainly, from what I know, from the contacts we have, is that this has not gone away. There's a lack of leadership, which is a problem, but there's a new sense of a movement there, which I think has not gone away. And also, some of the other images, which I thought were interesting, were women on the streets, and often older women on the streets, actually took on some of the government forces and, you know, started to hit them. And, you know, like, weren't afraid anymore. And, for instance, you know, you see instances where the morality police, which basically, you know, I think they were kind of known colloquially as the fashion police because of the fact that they were the ones that told you to cover yourself and check to see if you had name varnish on and all of those things, were taken on and defied in a way. They were defiant of the state for the first time, which to me was an extremely inspiring spectacle. So, since obviously we've had the arrests of many thousands, and one of those that I've mentioned already was Jaffer Panahi, who's the filmmaker, the director, who's made himself this film Offside, and also a film called The Circle, which shows the situation for women in a far more, I suppose, a more difficult and much more situation where women have escaped from prison or looking for refuge. And it shows the fear and the difficulty for women. They are all of these films have been made, obviously secretly, in Iran. He was arrested because he was a supporter of the movement, put in prison. He refused to accept bail to begin with, in solidarity with all those others who had been arrested. He then most recently went on hunger strike. There's been a huge outcry over his arrest, not simply because it was him, but because he personifies a whole movement that's been shut up in jail in order to completely annihilate it. And just days ago, he was released, which I find, again, it shows that we can do something, that the outcry that there has, the signature, the campaign that there has been throughout the world in horror, his arrest has had some impact within Iran. So whatever we do here in Ireland, even if there are small events, we can convey that we've done it to Iran, it will make an impact, it will have a resonance, and it will inspire and encourage people to continue to struggle. We continue, however, to struggle for the release of all political prisoners that are locked up in Iran, men and women. They are now basically behind bars because of their bravery and because they have resisted the state. To summarise, for me, my archives, and also the reason I've been involved in this is because I've always been inspired by the struggles in Iran. What I wanted to do was to kind of convey a sense to you of us making common cause, showing solidarity with this struggle, not because of it being a special struggle, but because we identify with it. It's one and the same. We stand shoulder to shoulder, not least because in Ireland, obviously, we too have lived and continue to live under a clerical state, although our repression is clearly less pronounced than women in Iran. But also because we want to change the world, and they are also part and parcel of that, and they are doing, they are actually taking on a state. But it's important to say that we should have no illusions in the United States, and certainly the United States often does in these circumstances try to portray itself as the liberator of women. We saw it in Iraq, we saw it in Afghanistan, and look at the situation today for women in Afghanistan. If anything, it's worse than the situation for women in Iran. It is terrible, it's truly terrible. The United States does not give a damn about women's rights. It does not give a damn. It is just a pretext to get involved in the fact that they are, at the moment, trying to get involved and have got their people in there, obviously trying to influence Iranian politics, to shift it to supporting, you know, some sort of puppet of the Iranians, being Mousavi and somebody else. Should not, you know, we should not be blind to the real intentions behind what they do. And we obviously need to be vigilant as a solidarity movement, but what we need to do is actually redouble our efforts to show solidarity so that people can see that it's not an American thing, but actually it's something for working class people internationally. And also I would say that we should have no illusions, the likes of Mousavi, as I already mentioned, he was part of the problem. So I'll finish it there, and thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak about this campaign. We are active in Dublin and in Cork. We have events, film showings, meetings, street stalls. We do circulate information about the situation in Iran. So please speak to us afterwards if you're speaking out.
I was thinking while Anne was talking there about Iran and just about how many misconceptions there are of Iran and maybe how confusing it can be for people, and I think definitely even for people within Iran. And I'll start just by saying that I'm a product of the revolution in Iran. My father came to the U.S. In 79, after our family had lost land and property and money and things that we had previous to the revolution that we gained because my grandfather was a colonel in the Shah's army. And my grandfather became a colonel in the Shah's army as a way to find protection from repression of the state against religious minorities in Iran, and my grandfather and grandmother were born Jews and Azeri Jews, so Jews from Azerbaijan and Tabriz in the northwest part of Iran, both converted to Islam, and then my grandfather joined the military eventually, and you know, found some kind of status position that he would not have had as an Azeri Jew within Iran, and that to say that Iran as a state is sort of a completely made up of all kinds of minorities, not only Azeris, but Baluchis, Kurds, Turks, many different kinds of people, and the only thing that sort of that really unites Iran today is speaking Farsi, but of course Farsi is the second language for many Iranians. My family's first language is a form of Turkish. I think that just to say that also points to the fact that there are a huge spectrum of different religions, beliefs, ethnicities that make up Iran. And so I think when you know, we get news about Iran in the West, if you will, in Europe or in America, there's this idea that you know, Iranians are either terrorists, which we know isn't true, or they're all Muslims or something, or there's there's not a whole spectrum of different political ideas or beliefs, and I think it's just important to point that out. And even when it comes to things like the recent protests in Iran, I have to be honest and say there were probably a lot of Iranians who did vote for Ahmadinejad, as well as a lot of Iranians who voted for Mousavi only because they saw a similar situation to what happened in the U.S. where people voted for Obama because they just were so sick of Bush. It seemed just a little bit better. And as an anarchist, I wouldn't advocate voting at all. But I think it's important to recognize that there is a spectrum of views in Iran. The only other thing I wanted to say is that in Iran, we had a constitutional revolution in 1905, and then because of Western imperialism in the country, we had the Shah and then the Shah's son, who ran the country in 1951. There was sort of a small revolution in Iran, in which case a man called Mohammad Mossadegh was democratically elected as a leader in Iran and then was subsequently taken out in coup d'etat by Britain and America. And I think after that, there was this strong sentiment against working with Americans, and some of what happened during Mohammad Mossadegh's time led to, or the seeds of the further revolution in 1979. And what happened in 1979 was very interesting. Anne pointed out that that the left was very weak, but I think, in my opinion, the left was very strong, and it led to the current regime that you have in Iran now, which is an Islamic republic. And there's not often an emphasis at all put on the fact that it's supposed to be a republic, but that is reflected in the actual governing structure of Iran, and it reflected in the many different viewpoints, political affiliations within the country currently. And so when it comes to women's rights in Iran, it's important to point out that there is a civil law that is supposedly not based on religious principles, that it is applicable supposedly to all individuals in Iran, but when it comes to women, the Sharia law, the Islamic law, is utilized. And this is one of the main issues that women rights advocates have, is that women in Sharia law are often defined in their role approximate to men, so either their mothers or their daughters or their aunts or their wives. They're never necessarily individuals within themselves, and so that's why the women in 2006 began a campaign to try to end the utilization of Islamic law to discriminate against women and to sort of reestablish women as individuals within civil law in Iran, which exists for men. And so in 2006, after a long, many decades of struggle advocating for women's rights, a group of women came together and decided that they were going to go around, not only in Tehran, but in Shiraz and Isfahan and Tabriz and many cities throughout Iran, and try to collect 1 million signatures to present to the parliament in Iran to try to end this use of Sharia law when it comes to the status of women. And so since they have done that, they've utilized a lot of different avenues in order to try to gain women's rights. And this is, again, where it comes to a spectrum now. Many women in the 1 million signatures campaign might see themselves as secular or as atheist, while other women within the campaign will see themselves as very devoutly religious, and many of them Muslim, but also from other faiths, and they have to utilize both in order to try to talk to different groups of people in order to secure their rights. So the 1 million signatures campaign has been involved in not only ending discriminatory laws, but how those laws are used economically against women. For example, when if two people are married and in Iran there are gay people, of course, but they're not recognized in law. There's no homosexuality is actually illegal in Iran. But when a straight couple, if you will, are married in Iran and the man dies, the wife has no legal right to property that is owned by the couple, has no legal right to the whatever finances. And those finances are actually supposed to be divided amongst the sons of the family. So it's not just that sort of on the surface that women don't have rights, but they actually it's economic in nature as well. And I think Anne covered the fact that when we hear about what's women's rights in Iran, we mostly focus on things like whether or not the veil is mandatory or not. And I was talking to my grandmother, who is 87 years old, and in her lifetime, because she lived in the 40s when the veil was mandatorily taken off women in Iran, and then through 1979 when it was mandatorily put back on women. And this is, really, I think, signifies or is an example of what the society is like. I think, as Anne said, I won't take too much more time, but as Anne said, there is a great sort of divide amongst people about whether or not they want an Islamic Republic. And I think the 1979 revolution was designed to make model Islamic citizens, if you will, and that's really failed disastrously so. And so I think the only sort of place where the state has power over women's lives currently, over people's lives in Iran, is the public sphere. And that's why you see, if you go to Iran today, you can find things that are supposedly illegal, alcohol or, all kinds of things that the government didn't want to have after the 79 revolution are prominent, people using blogs or people having political conversations that the state would disapprove of. I mean, these kinds of things happen all the time in Iran. For very many reasons, I think the Islamic revolution failed, but it was also a failure of the left to sort of utilize its power to really make the republic part of the Islamic Republic robust for people. The last thing I'll say just is that. If you are working within the system, just like any time, if you don't protest against the government in Iran, you can be legitimized by the state apparatus. So there are women who are members of parliament in Iran. There are women who are seen as religious leaders within religious communities in Iran, and mostly you'll find that these women won't say anything about the government, of course, but it's not a society, necessarily a society where you won't see that. You will see that, definitely. It's just a matter, of course, like anywhere, of being able to speak freely, to live your life as you'd like to live it, to have your individual rights, and that is a struggle that we can see from the last year is not just for women, but all people in society.
In the opinion of the panelists, what is the potential for change in Iran given the strength of the regime and its ability to use repression to suppress demonstrations and the oppositional movement? It's been relatively successful historically. What is the potential for change there? Is there really possibly a change there?
Well, I mean, my view on it would be that there is a possibility for change, but I think that the difficulty is the lack of leadership. And one of the problems, obviously, I would be a socialist. I think that we need socialist working class organisation in Iran, and there are plenty of people in Iran who would agree with that. But the trouble is their ability to organise. That's the isolating nature of the state. The fact that it's as Farah says, it's often not successful in implementing its agenda and creating this modern Islamic state. What it's very good at is harassing and making it very difficult for people to organise. So I think the potential is there. I don't know if there will be change, but I think that Iran is interesting because of its location, within the Middle East, and the fact that it is a society which has seen great change and which has seen massive, secular change. And I think if something did happen in Iran, then I think that it would actually change the entire Middle East. I think it really has. People do look to Iran, I mean, often for the wrong reasons in terms of the government. But I think if Iran is such a melting pot that if it did change, if there was a revolution in Iran, I think it would have a major effect on the rest of the Middle East. So, I mean, what we're trying to do, we're connecting with the people in Iran, within the student movement, within trade unions, who are trying to organise themselves, and we're trying to give them some assistance with that, either by helping people if they need to leave the country and their lives are in danger, which often is the case, but also in terms of circulating for them the information about what's going on and assisting them with use of the internet so that they can connect with each other. So I think that's an important thing that we need to do, that we need to take responsibility for as well.
Just to add to that, I've had this conversation many times with people over the last year since the resurgence of the protests, and you have to ask, when you say, will there be change, what kind of change? And a lot of people wanted change from the Shah, and who got was the Islamic Republic. So I don't, and because, like, I was trying to represent, there's such differing opinions on what Iran should be. Should Islam have some role in Iran? Should it not? In Iran, there's not the same concept that we have here about secularization. I think there's a need in Iran to separate the mosque or religious institutions from civil institutions. But it's not. But there isn't a will to reject religion entirely from the society as well. I don't really know. I think that the biggest thing, and one of the platforms for somebody who's running in the last elections, is that they wanted to get rid of the Guardian Council in Iran, which was a council after the revolution, and they came up with this really experimental sort of Islamic Republic. There is a parliament, but there's also on top of the parliament a Guardian Council of religious leaders who are able to basically say yes or no to any sort of legislation that goes through the parliament. And the religious leaders are not democratically elected. They're often the most conservative, and it's a patriarchal system. There are no women who are on the Guardian Council. And so I think in terms of institutional reforms, getting rid of the Guardian Council, this body that controls law in Iran would be a good step, but also having conversations within Iran about what their society would look like, what kind of change do they want. Those are really, really big questions that I don't think that the current movement happening over the past year has been able to answer. I think one of the biggest things, and something that we actually have on the WS and Worker Solidarity, I have to pick it up because there's an article in there about one of one of the laws that has been reprised in Iran recently called Muharrabe, which means being at enmity with God. And the regime used this in the 1980s to kill dissent in the country, and basically they're calling anybody who protests the government people who are the enemy of God and executed. And so far there have been 10 people executed, and their crimes have been people who actually organized against the state during the protests, and other people who just happened to be caught up in some of the protests who might have thrown a rock at the police, or you know, maybe that day made a decision to come out and hold a banner, that are being executed. There are 52 more people on death row in Iran for this particular crime, and there are over 6,000 people in prison who have been part of the protests in Iran currently who are political prisoners. So I think starting there, you know, releasing people from prison and ending Muharrabe, but then, you know, after that, I really don't know, and those are conversations that will take a long, long time to resolve.
Yes, can you tell me what has happened with the million signatures, you know, if it has had any impact? And also, is there any idea of organizing something like that outside of Iran?
Before the protests, the women's rights movement in Iran was the biggest social movement in the country. And that's mostly because it's been heavily repressed by the state. And so I'd say it's difficult to know exactly what the gains are for women, because is legal reform really something that we want within a state that's already repressive, that treats minorities badly? You know, I don't know necessarily if that's something to be desired, but in terms of specific things, the age of a woman in Iran that can be married has changed from the age of 9 into the age of 13, and that was a gain by the 1 million signatures, by activists in the 1 million signatures campaign, speaking to Islamic leaders in Qom, in the religious capital of Iran, who came out with fatwas saying that this is an inappropriate age for a woman to be married. Outside of that, there's also been gains on a certain kind of law called blood money, whereas in Iran previously, if somebody killed somebody, the family of the person who had done the killing had to pay blood money to the person, to the family whose son or daughter was killed, if you will. And if it was a woman, then it was only half the amount of a man. And that's changed so that if you kill a woman, it's the same amount of blood money. It's still the case that in many courts, the testimony of a woman is worth half of that of a man. And that's one of the current reforms that the 1 million signatures campaign is working on. I think that there's just like any country, I think that, you know, there are online petitions that you can sign to support solidarity of women in Iran. I think that, you know, informing yourself, becoming aware of the situation of women in Iran is very good. I think, like, they don't get enough credit for the work that they are doing for women's rights, and you know, when people talk about women in Islam, I think they should remember the women who are fighting very hard and against great odds, you know, for their rights. Not just talk about how women have no rights. So I guess that, you know, and that comes through awareness. But like I said, if you can come to the Hopi stalls, any kind of international solidarity that you do for other causes, you know, it's the same for women's rights. There aren't any particular groups within Ireland, besides Hopi, that really does hands-on activism for Iran, but of course coming out to there, I think, just like anything, the more solidarity it seems for people outside the country, you know, where the regime might see that there are thousands of protesters in the streets of Dublin, that it can make a change, it can make a difference in terms of individuals in Iran. I think I used to work for Amnesty International, and one thing that did make a difference there was letter writing to people who've been imprisoned, not for the people more than for the guards and the government officials that keep them in prison if they notice that there are people watching the situation, obviously, especially the Mojarebe, the people who Amnesty would thought if the government knows that people are watching that situation, would be less likely to kill them. So.
I'd like you to comment on something that's been reported and made much of in Western media in recent years, is that the age profile in Iran is supposedly quite young, something like 70% of people in their 20s. I want you to say, first of all, if that is true, if it is true, how come that change can't be affected at local government and local and central government by people becoming involved in politics, not necessarily nailing their colours to the mast before they get installed. Is such, if people are so fed up with the old ways of doing things if they're young, is that demographic likely to change, and is the momentum, if it exists, likely to be lost if something doesn't happen soon?
I'm pretty sure that it's something like 80%. It's something like 80% of the population is under 30.
65.
Sorry, I was over it. But I mean, clearly that's very true, and I think that's an important aspect of the current struggle, that there is such a young population, a population that wants to basically live and be free, in general terms, and say, that has got that energy of youth. And obviously, and you asked the second question, that would that be lost? Well, clearly, we've seen this before in Iran. Throughout the 1990s, students in Iran struggled and were extremely viciously repressed by Hatami, who was an ally of the current so-called oppositionists in Iran, Mousavi. They voted for him to reform the situation, and ended up being some of the first targets of this repression. So my view is that it is impossible to reform the present regime. I take your point about people standing for elections, but I don't know how easy it is for somebody to stand in an election the problem is that you actually are handpicked a lot of the time. Guardian Council, for instance, were the ones that picked the presidential candidates, and that's one of the problems. You ended up with the last three to come to be allowed, from something like, I don't know how many hundred of people put themselves forward. So that is one of the fundamental things, is the ability to even actually be able to stand, because you have to be approved to stand. I mean, Farah said something about the changes, the demands. I mean, I certainly think myself, although obviously I accept that you have to make clear that you're not against people practicing religion, as the left wing, but what you're against is a religious state. And I think it is vital for the left in Iran and the workers' movement in Iran to make that call. And in fact, I think, although Farah said it hasn't dealt with the question, there have been among some of the trade unionists, there have been calls of that to that effect, where they're calling for an end to the present regime and for a secular state in Iran. So that's really my response.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's not just up to young people to create change in the country, but like I said, I think many young people just generally speaking, the way that they've sort of pushed back on the regime trying to make them these model Islamic citizens is not necessarily by organizing, but by wanting cell phones and any other thing like any other consumer society wants. And so, unfortunately, I think that largely young people in Iran, you know, are sort of caught up just like everywhere else in sort of capitalist system. I think also, as Anne mentioned, that during the reforms in the late 90s under Khatami, there was a lot of hope that there could be some gains in at least opening up some of the newspapers or making life a lot less restricted. And because Khatami, some people say he didn't do it he didn't implement the reforms for lots of different reasons. Some people said he couldn't, and some people said he didn't want to. I think that after that period, there was just and which led to Ahmadinejad, there was just this idea that there's something you can do to change the regime. And I think that people were so got to a point where they were so sick with what was going on under Ahmadinejad that they had tried again. But like Anna was saying, Mousavi is not the Green Movement, and the election of Mousavi won't be a radical reform of the government. And just like any other people group, but you know, I'd say like you want to encourage trade unions to organize people, or poor people's campaign, or women's rights groups. So it's not just up to the young people. And also to say, I think that there's this perception that young people are somehow unified in their opposition to the government, because you see a lot of the sort of middle class young people in footage of Iran. Certainly those people are helping to organize the protests, but it's people from all, that's what made these last protests so successful and so disappointing in a way, was because it was all kinds of different people, trade unionists, you know, rural people, farmers, women, all kinds of people that organized to try to at least elect a reform government or protest against the rigging of the elections in Iran, and it was wonderful while it lasted, and I hope there will continue to be international solidarity. But really, it's across all kinds of lines, and young people are just like any other people. You know, they're for and against the government, radical and not.
I have a question while I'm on the way. I'm aware that some religious minorities are particularly. Find it particularly problematic in Iran, particularly for the Baha'i faith. Are they organising alongside the women's movements and the trade unions, or is it very separate?
Well, unfortunately, the Iranian government has done a really good job of driving Baha'is out of Iran, or you know, silencing them. You know, I can honestly say, in particular, have I heard of Baha'is as Baha'is organizing alongside other organizations like a women or something. I think that there are lots of Baha'is still in Iran, but they won't organize as a, do you understand what I mean, as a Baha'i group, because they will be repressed like they have in the past. So I haven't heard of any specifically Baha'i, but I know that Baha'is, because they've been repressed, are some of the most eager to protest the regime.
This audio, recorded at the 2010 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair, is about the reform movement in Iran and the Million Signatures campaign in particular. You'll find more audio from the book fair at www.wsm.ie/bookfair. The audio was recorded and edited by Andrew Flood.